Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show, prescribing hope for healthy families here on American Family Radio. Here's your host, Professor, Pediatric Nurse Practitioner, and Mom of Four, Dr. Jessica Peck.
Well, hey there, friends, and welcome to my favorite part of the afternoon, getting to spend time with you prescribing hope for healthy families on my favorite day of the week. It is Friday, or Fri-yay, as we like to say, and we say a big, giant yay this week because this has been Share-a-thon week. So thank you so much to everyone who has supported, who called in. It's not too late. You can still give. We are so appreciative of our listeners who support this ministry so that we can be here on the radio waves, on your podcast, on your drive, on your walk, in your home, giving you words of hope and healing for today's family. So thank you so much to all of you who gave in that, and we are still celebrating all that God has done. On Friday, we talk about 52 habits for healthy families, and I will be doing that today and answering questions related to those. If you've been following along since January, we started off in January of 2025 with some basic spiritual disciplines: prayer, memorizing scripture, going to church, playing worship music, practicing gratitude, a daily devotional, morning routine. We moved into some of those rhythms with this that you need for your family to create consistency, to create safety nets within your family so that you can have building blocks for resilience. That's morning routine, bedtime routine, sleep hygiene, having family dinner together, or maybe it's breakfast in your family, having a weekly check-in. And then for the last 4 weeks, we've been talking about some pretty deep stuff, some communication skills. We've been unrooting patterns of dysfunctional generational relationships that we may have inherited and how we find hope in those. And I hope that you know, as I've been talking to you over the last 4 weeks, especially I've been talking to me, because these are things that I struggle with. And no matter what age or life stage you're in, these are communication skills you need to make your family stronger. We need to listen to each other with our face. We need to give each other words of affirmation. We need to apologize sincerely. If you have missed those shows, please go back and listen to the Friday shows. Just download those three right in a row, the last three Friday shows before this, because it builds on what we're talking about today. And these things, again, like I talked about last week, we have a choice. Having existing in those patterns of generational dysfunction are difficult, and they're hard, and they're draining, and they're destructive, but it leads to a path of destruction and death. When we're trying to learn new ways, it's difficult, it's hard, it can feel soul crushing, it can feel discouraging, but it leads to a path of life. And that is something worth pursuing. So this week, we'll be wrapping up that talking about some healthy communication. And this week, I want to talk about writing letters and answer some questions that I have about writing letters and how this is so powerful. And I want to encourage you to write letters to your family. Now, this may seem counterintuitive, and you may think, all right, I'm mildly intrigued, but how does this all relate? Well, this is something that's timeless but often overlooked in the pace of today's society. Handwritten notes, heartfelt words, messages that transcend time. We live in a world today of instant messaging, of direct messaging, of text messaging, of emails, of social media, of even communicating by emojis, which, by the way, if I ever try to text my husband an emoji, he will just flat out tell me, I do not speak emoji. I cannot interpret your meaning by emoji. Please give me some words, which is fair and which is very true. But we're going to explore the time today to talk about why writing a letter to a loved one is one of the most powerful gifts that you can give. And I want you to think back to the last time that maybe you received a letter. I'm talking about a handwritten letter. Maybe it was left on your car under your windshield wiper. Maybe it was left somewhere in the house. Maybe it was mailed to you. So for you younger listeners, there's this thing called the United States Mail Service that sends paper in the mail on a truck to a mailbox. I'm kidding. But really, that is something that kids don't really get. They don't get mail. So that's something we can use to our advantage, because getting something in the mail is intriguing. They don't see spam mail like we do a lot. They think, what is that? Maybe yours was a birthday card with a handwritten note. Maybe it was a letter from your grandparent. Maybe it was an intricately folded origami note from high school. You know, we made this into an art form, how you folded the letters. It's like pull here. And then, you know, all of a sudden you have a swan that comes out of this paper. It was a really beautiful time of life. This is the Gen X in me speaking, but the words in that letter, they stay with us. A quick text just disappears in a flood of notifications. A letter is different. It's tangible. It's a keepsake and can be read over and over again if you're feeling joyful or sad or maybe just nostalgic. There are emotional and psychological benefits of letter writing. Studies show that letter writing has profound ability to strengthen relationships, to foster emotional intelligence, to give us a therapeutic outlet to express love and gratitude and forgiveness. And it engages our brains differently. When we look at how our brains react, when we're writing a letter, our brains function on a totally different level than they are when we're speaking or we're texting. And it reflects that our brain is actually engaging in deeper reflection and being more intentional. And writing a letter slows us down. We can often voice text, which my kids just give me the hardest time about because it's misspelling. It can misunderstand you, say things you certainly did not intend to say. It doesn't make sense. But writing a letter helps us slow down and communicate with clarity and sincerity. And it taps into that part of our brain that's responsible for very deep emotional processing. It also helps us solidify memories and it strengthens emotional bonds in a way that digital communication simply cannot. And that is the science, my friends. I promise you that. Family letter writing traditions. I want you to imagine the impact if you had a tradition of writing letters. Now, sometimes families may do this on their birthdays or on holidays or special occasions. In my book, Behind Closed Doors, I challenge families to write something I call legacy letters. And I give you 12 prompts in here, especially this is for preteens and teenagers, on how to write messages that matter, maybe that are even meant to be opened in the future, maybe by kids when they graduate or they get married. I know I've always been big into letter writing. I inherited that from my granny. But as I've had kids who have graduated from high school, opening letters that their great-grandparents, even great-great-grandparents, wrote to them on their first birthday, and opening those when they graduate from high school, when those loved ones are no longer with us, and yet they're still speaking words of affirmation over their life, showing their love and care, that they were thinking about that child graduating, knowing that they likely would not be there, but wanting to express love and concern and support and cheer them on. Let me tell you, there was not a dry eye in the room. It was pretty special. And that can be something that you can do to build a tradition that has connection and preserves memories and just provides hope and linkages of healthy family relationships. You might write a letter to your child every year on their birthday or keep them in a box to give them on their wedding day. Can you imagine the power of reading those years of love and wisdom and encouragement all at once? Or maybe it's when they go to college. Maybe it can be something more simple, like writing a letter to them. Imagine this. Imagine your kid is going out on a Friday night and you walk into their room after they've already left and their bed is a train wreck and their room is a mess and you just feel that irritation. You can't wait for them to come home and say, you know, you were supposed to have your stuff done before you went out, and meet them with irritation. Or what if once in a while, I'm not saying this has to be an everyday thing because there needs to be responsibilities and boundaries and consequence, but sometimes doing something unexpected can really shift the tone in a relationship. So imagine if your teen comes home knowing, I didn't clean my room, my mom's probably going to gripe at me, but instead they walk into their room and they see their room is picked up, that their bed is made. Maybe even the sheets are washed and it looks like a hotel bed. And there's a little letter on the pillow that says, Hey, I hope you had a good time tonight. I'm praying for you. These are the things that I see about you that I love. Here's some character traits I wanted to affirm. And I just want you to know that no matter wherever you are, wherever you go, when you come home, you will always have a home here. You are always welcome here. Can you imagine the power of that? That would be amazingly powerful. Let me share with you another story from my book, Behind Closed Doors. I wrote a chapter in there about divorce. And I challenged the readers who had experienced divorce, or those who hadn't. There were different prompts, but this particular mom had experienced divorce. I challenged her to write a letter to her son affirming the things that she loved and appreciated in him that he got from his dad, acknowledging this would be very, very hard to do. And this is what she wrote back to me. Last year, I felt lost and hopeless. I felt like I was failing as a mom. I divorced and my son was angry and hurt. He shut me out of his life. Our only conversations were arguments. He started hanging out with troubled kids. I caught him drinking. He was failing school. His dad didn't want to see him anymore. And this caused my son to spiral emotionally. I was desperate. My sister put your book into my hands. I read the chapter on divorce and wept my way through it. When I read the Legacy Letter Challenge, I knew I had to do it, even though it was incredibly difficult. The prompt was write a letter praising the positive qualities your teen inherited from their other parent. Tell them no matter how the relationship ended, they are a gift to cherish with no regrets. I wrote the letter. I left it on his bed. He didn't say anything for 2 weeks. Then he shared. He thought, I hated his dad, and he was half his dad, so I must hate half of him, and he hated all of himself. Writing this letter started a journey of healing for us. We have a long way to go. We are in therapy, but we are unlocking doors with conversation keys, and I'm writing more legacy letters. Thank you for giving us a lifeline. Now, that wasn't me. That was her obedience. That was God working through the power of words. Because sometimes when we sit down and we can really think about what we're saying, we're going to give a completely different message than if we're on the spot and trying to navigate the emotions of the moment. We can write it, think about it, pray about it, come back, edit it if we need to. It's really important. But when we look back over at the evolution of communication, it is pretty profound to see how much communication has changed over the last four generations. And I have to ask, when we look at that shift from handwritten letters and face-to-face conversations to now what we have is texting, even if we're in the same household, right? How often do we text our spouse or our child who is just in the next room? We lose that opportunity for face-to-face communication. Are we losing something really valuable in this process of convenience? I don't know. I think that we might. So let's look back to this generational shift in communication. The 1950s to before the 1950s up to the 1980s pretty much was the same. We have the handwritten era. We have letters. We have postcards. We have notes as the primary form of distant communication. Let me tell you, your penmanship was a social status. My husband's grandfather has the most he's passed away and gone on to be with the Lord, but he had the most beautiful penmanship you could ever, ever imagine. Just absolutely gorgeous. And that was something that showed he had an education and he took that seriously. He was a gentleman. It was an education and culture, and emotional depth was in written letters. There can be some pretty intense emotions that are expressed, and people saved them as keepsakes. Then we rose to the telephone and print era. We had 1950s, 1990s. That was 40 years where communication essentially was the same. It was written notes in school. It was postcards. It was letters. But we had the telephone, and that still was live interaction, that voice that carried emotions and deepened conversations. But we still saw that greeting cards and written correspondence were still pretty prevalent. Many of you can probably remember what it was like to dial on a party line or to call with no caller ID. It's busy, it's busy, it's busy. I'm just going to go over there. Or maybe you took that cord and stretched it all the way down the hall into the bathroom so you could have a moment's peace and hope somebody else doesn't pick up the line and listen. But when we had the 1990s and email, the world was never the same. I'll talk more about this when we come back. Don't go away. We're talking more about the healthy habit of writing letters to your family. I'll see you on the other side of this break. Because of listeners like you, Preborn helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR. Will you take a moment and celebrate life with me? Last year, Preborn helped to rescue over 67,000 babies from abortion. Hi, this is Jessica Peck, host of the Dr. Nurse Mama Show, and I want to thank you for your partnership. Think about what you did. 67,000 babies are taking their first breath now because of you. Your $28 sponsored one ultrasound that was given to a woman as she was deciding about the future of her child. Once she saw her precious baby for the first time and heard their sweet heartbeat, her baby's chance at life doubled. But Preborn's mission is not only to rescue babies' lives, but also to lead women to Christ. Last year, Preborn Network Clinic saw 8,900 women receive salvation. Your help is crucial to continue their life-saving work. Your caring, tax-deductible donation saves lives. So please be generous. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. Or dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Your love can save a life. Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR. Welcome back, friends. That is Oh But God by Davey Flowers. And God is rich in mercy. And we have the incredible blessing of being able to share that with our families. We're talking today on Friday about writing letters to your family and the effect that it has in your relationship. I want to share with you a verse from 2 Corinthians chapter 3, and it says, "You yourselves are our letter of recommendation written on our hearts to be known and read by all." And I think about this and think about how our children, it's been said before that our children are a letter that we are sending to a generation we'll never see. Our children's legacy is the letter that is written on our hearts, and we have the ability to shape that letter of their life with the letters that we write to them. Before the break, I was talking about the dramatic shift in communication where we had from before the 1950s all the way up to the 1980s, just primarily written communication. And all the way for 40 years after that, we added the telephone. That really the biggest advance on the telephone was call waiting, or maybe calling movie phone to see what time the movies are, what time is the weather, maybe calling the operator. How many of you called collect, you know, and then your family would reject the call, right? But no to call you back so they could pay for it on their long distance bill. I mean, these things were calling cards. I remember my husband and I were long distance in much of our early dating relationship, and he would save up his money for a calling card. But it was still that voice to voice live communication, that voice that carried emotion, that we would learn to sense subtle things. How many times can you think of if you called someone who loves you and you just say hello and they say, "What's wrong?" They immediately know that something is wrong. You don't get that kind of nuance in text. So In the 1990s, we had the rise of email and the early digital era. So this switched to email for formal and personal communication, and instant responses became the norm, and early social media really changed the way that young people interacted. So millennials will tell you about this, about having a million, you know, IM messages, windows open where they're carrying on multiple conversations at once. This started to fracture our attention span. And really, if you look at that, that still was pretty slow. That was about 20 years we existed like that. But just since 2010, that's when the tablet was invented, the iPad was invented and became widely accessible in mass marketing, the smartphone and social media age. In the last 15 years, our world is not the same. We have texting, we have social media. Those are dominant communication methods. We talk to people we do not know. It depersonalizes them. We say things online we would never say in person. When you type things, there's not tone in there. So you don't know, is this sarcasm? Is this funny? Is this just downright mean? Is it insensitive? We have a loss of deep intentional conversations in favor of brevity. We want emojis. We want abbreviations. Just ask any Gen Z when you LOL, which means laugh out loud pretty much and most acceptable things. But, you know, like maybe an older person in my family who shall remain nameless thought that means lots of love. And so you can imagine when you're saying LOL back and one person thinks it means laugh out loud and the other means lots of love, there is a generation disconnect in those things. And when we have Gen Z who thinks the use of punctuation is rude, we have a problem. And you can see how, you know, if you type with punctuation, my kids will ask me, why are you being so aggressive? Why are you being so formal? What's wrong? I can't interpret your tone, because we don't know those digital norms and communication that they know. We also have these video calls can help, voice memos can help, but it doesn't replace written or in-person conversations. Now we have AI-generated messages. We have auto responses. And if you have an AI assistant on your email, it's just, oh, please respond to that. And it just feels so impersonal. The rise of Reels and Instagram and micro content has significantly shortened attention spans, and it conditions kids to expect instant entertainment, quick dopamine hits with that communication, and this constant barrage of rapid fire content, rapid fire communication. It just makes it really difficult to engage in deep, meaningful conversations or just to sit with their thoughts. Sometimes on text messages, especially for teenagers, though, they'll be much more vulnerable than they would be in person. And sometimes that can blur the boundaries of appropriate relationships and what you're sharing and what you're not sharing, because it's easier to type something than it is to say it. At the same time, we have all of this micro digital content that is disposable, by the way, and digital. No kid in Generation Alpha saves their text messages. They just don't. They're just accustomed now to information and messaging being disposable. Photos are also disposable. It's fine. It can delete because I can just get more. It's just a conversation in the moment. But kids do crave real connection, just like we do as adults, and belonging. Yet many feel intimidated, or they just feel really anxious at the thought of navigating these face-to-face interactions. I've said it before, I'll stand by it. If you want to really make a Gen Z nervous, just show up at their door and ring the doorbell. Don't text, don't call in advance, just show up. And they're like, what are you doing here? You're supposed to text first. That is etiquette. But they do crave conversation. And this is why I think I see such a rise of influencer grandparent culture, where we have a granny couture, where kids are going through their grandmother's closets and they want to wear all of their things. And we see them engaging in playing records, and they want those things that are a slower pace of life. They want those real connections. And social media really creates an illusion of connection, but it's just surface level engagement. And it leaves a lot of young people just isolated and not sure how to build those genuine relationships. They feel awkward. They feel rejected, fear of rejection, or just not knowing what to say. It just makes in-person conversation seem overwhelming. And it just makes them think, okay, I want that connection, but I feel safer and more confident here in the digital world, so I'll stay here. We have to help today's kids rebuild their confidence in a world, in a real world communication. And it requires some patience and some practice and for us to model that. So when we see the loss of handwriting in this generation and the deep communication impacts we have in social and emotional development, they can't articulate their deep emotions in writing. It's like just, you know, just one word. I'm just accustomed to responding in one word. We have short-term communication that literally limits their vocabulary and their emotional expression because I can only express whatever is available to me in emojis, right? I'm looking for that right emojis. And then as adults, we don't understand. Like I sent a text message to one of my kids. They sent me back a skull emoji. Well, what does this mean? Like, are you dead? Are you a pirate? Are you thinking about getting a tattoo? Like these are my things. And they're like, no, mom, that means that's funny. How does a skull mean that's funny? What means like I'm dead laughing. Like I'm old. This is when I start to feel really, really old. But again, we see that increased anxiety in face-to-face interactions because I can order everything on my app. I can do everything on an app. We also see this in relationship and conflict resolution skills. We see digital arguments are escalating much faster than in-person interactions. Like it really, a conversation will escalate really quickly. And what do you mean by that? And then we just see cut off because we can unfriend people. We have that loss of nuanced communication. It's so hard to feel, what is your tone? I don't interpret your tone or your intent. It's really hard to apologize sincerely. Just a one word sorry text isn't going to cut it. Or thanks. That doesn't cut it. Because as parents, we feel like sometimes we give our heart and soul and we move our schedule and we move heaven and earth to be there. And if your kid just texts you a K, thanks, it is not the same. And then we find ourselves being irritated and maybe even resentful. Our attention span is also lower because handwriting and letter writing requires patience and thoughtfulness. It takes longer to write. We have this instant gratification culture, but it makes deep connections harder to maintain. And we have micro content, so it's hard to say something longer. It's like, I just want to solve this in a 2-sentence text. Well, sorry, not sentences, a 2-line text, right? Because we're not using grammar. But there's good things about it too. I don't want Gen Z and Gen Alpha to think that I'm hating on them because I am not. There are creative ways to express ourselves, but there's room for both. And there's room for old school social skills and new world view is how we view the world of interaction. There's room for that. But this shift can affect our family relationships too, because we've got parents who are now competing with screens for attention. We used to only compete with reading the back of the cereal box, or maybe you were going to actually like cut out the word find on the back of the cereal box before the cereal was in fact gone. Has anybody ever been there? Okay, it's just me. All right. Loss of meaningful parent-child conversations because we're constantly distracted. We have constant notifications, constant dings, whether it is she who shall not be named, that our instant assistant, I can't even say the name on your phone or in your house because it will make everybody's go off. I don't want to do that. Who is giving you updates or text updates. And it's hard to struggle to express those, to not be distracted by that. Look, I'm distracted now. Sibling and peer relationships, we have social media, we have texting that replace that in-person interaction and conflicts that happen over text rather than a face-to-face conversation. And we have less practice in empathy and active listening. We have grandparents or older generations who feel out of touch with younger family members because how do I communicate with you if I don't text? My grandmother, she wanted to learn how to text, but she had a flip phone. So trying to text was, you know, like 3-3-3-2-2, whatever number combination. The first time she sent me a text, I said, who is this? And who has kidnapped my grandmother? And about 30 minutes later, I got a text back because it took her that long. But what a communication of love to me that she wanted to communicate. I needed to just pick up the phone, just go by her house. And we have also a loss of family history. and storytelling, because we don't have written letters. So many times when you think about our country's history, you look at letters that were written that preserve that. Now it just disappears. So we need to bring back some old school social skills to strengthen families. I believe this. Reintroduce handwritten communication. I want you to encourage your kids to write a thank you note, to write a letter to their grandparents, to journal their thoughts, or maybe you can start a family letter writing tradition. Maybe this is just a simple note in a lunchbox or a post-it note on their bathroom mirror, a simple word of affirmation, something where they see your handwriting and they know exactly who it is immediately. We have to prioritize the face-to-face and voice communication. So setting tech-free times, and don't worry, we'll be talking about tech-free summer quite a bit when we talk about habits. And do something to encourage opportunity for deeper conversation rather than just those quick exchanges. We've got to resolve our conflict face-to-face, not through text message. And now that might be writing a letter of apology and following up with a conversation, but we got to write out our thoughts before just reacting impulsively online or in a text message or a voice memo. These things can all help rebuild attention spans and patience. And those are skills that are required for healthy relationships. So reading physical books or doing crafting or storytelling or writing things out or actually having handwriting. I know some of you are just sitting in your cars right now just saying like, preach, yes, let's bring back the handwriting. Let's bring back all of the book reading clubs. I'm with you. I'm with you, friend. But so much of that is dictated by the screen time that we have. So I really want to encourage you to adopt this habit of writing letters to your family. And you may be thinking, hey, I love that, but where do I start? What do I do? Well, don't worry. I got you covered. Here's a few simple ways that you can begin. I want you to start small. Maybe just write a short note to a family member today, your spouse, your child, your parent. It doesn't have to be lengthy. It can even be a post-it note. Just write a little something and then make it a habit. Set aside a specific time each month or make it a habit to every once in a while leave them a note on their dresser, on their car windshield, on their bathroom mirror. Just set aside a specific time. I know I do that usually on Monday morning. I'm writing letters to just whoever the Lord puts on my heart, just a word of thanks or encouragement. Maybe it's a letterbox that you have where you start writing letters to your kid for the future. And that they can be little or they can be bigger, but just start writing them letters that you want them to have that family history, that life lesson. And you have a letter box there. And encourage your kids to join in. Maybe you teach them to write notes of gratitude or encouragement to their siblings, their grandparents, or even future versions of themselves. Write letters for the future to open at future life events, a graduation, a wedding, or maybe a tough time. And you may be thinking, my family is not the letter writing type. That's okay. You can make it fun and engaging. Leave a surprise note around the house. Or if you write a letter with a prompt like, one thing I admire about you is, maybe you have a family journal where everybody just contributes over time. It's like a book you have, but you do it over time. I challenge you. Take just a minute to write a note to somebody you love. It doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be real. When I come back, we'll have a very serious topic to talk about, but something that I really think all parents should know. I'll be back on the other side of this break.
Here's Dr. John Oswalt from the American Family Studios documentary, The God Who Speaks.
One of the remarkable things about the God of the Bible is that he is a God who speaks. The writers of the Bible again and again talk of him as the living God, and when they do, they include this idea that the idols are dumb. They cannot speak. Language is an incredible mystery, really. What is it that makes human beings able to communicate in word? Personally, I think that is the image of God in us, because God speaks. Right at the beginning of the Bible, God spoke the world into existence. It did not somehow evolve from his body. It was something that he spoke.
Visit thegodwhospeaks.org.
My Jesus, my Savior, oh, there is none like you. All of my days I want to praise the wonders of your mighty my shelter, tower of refuge and strength. Let every breath, all that I am, never cease to worship you. Shout to the Lord on the earth, let us see power.
Welcome back, friends. That is Shout to the Lord by Darlene Check, featuring Zoe Cameron and the Australian Christian Orchestra. Now, many of you, I know that song, have sung it for decades. I know I have. It is one of my favorites. If you want to continue to make fun of me, I'll say, oh, sure, it's in my top 10, which there's like 520 songs in my top 10. I love that song. If you miss Darlene Check, she is a worship leader who lives in Australia. She is has written so many songs that are so encouraging. She was on the show on February 5th and has a new devotional out called Testament. And fun fact, that song features Zoe Cameron, which is actually her youngest daughter. So how fun to be able to talk about leading a generation in worship. And that's what we're talking about today. If you missed the first part of the show, it is Friday. It is Ask Dr. Nurse Mama Friday. I talked about writing letters of affirmation to your family, writing letters, legacy letters to your family. This wraps up 4 weeks of communication skills, listening with your face, words of affirmation, apologizing sincerely, and writing letters. If you missed those Friday shows, go back and listen to them. And from time to time, there are some things that I feel compelled to talk with you about to make sure that families are aware of. This is a tough topic, and you may want to adjust your listening ears. So I'm going to give you a moment for that. If you have small ears around, sensitive ears around, it would be good to go back and listen to this at another time, and to make sure they have little ears away. But this is something that families really need to know about. And I'm talking about the month of April being Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Now, this is something that is on my heart for prevention for families, because this can happen as completely, even with parents who are vigilant, even with kids who have the best of intentions, who you try to do everything that you can as a family, sometimes things still happen. And so I want to talk to you about it a little bit and give you a trauma-informed, really developmentally appropriate approach. And this matters because when we're looking at statistics, we see that approximately 1 in 5 women in the United States, about 21%, have experienced a significant sexual assault during their lifetime. And nearly 1 in 38 men have experienced that as well. Over half of female assault victims report being assaulted by an intimate partner, 40.8% by an acquaintance. So sometimes, especially with children, this is people they know or they think they know. But in the reporting estimates tell us that only about a quarter, we know in 2018, only about a quarter of assaults were reported, and that was a decrease in 40% from the year before. And there's some real barriers around reporting. We know that this is very costly, relationally, emotionally, spiritually, mentally, psychologically, but also financially. The estimated cost is about $122,000, considering medical cost, lost productivity, criminal justice, seeking criminal justice, other related expenses. And of course, these are just some statistics that are representative of some experience. But the bottom line is that this is happening. And it's really important for us as parents to talk to our kids about prevention, starting very, very young. And parents may not know how to do that. They may think, that's so uncomfortable to bring up that conversation, but we can do it in a developmentally appropriate way. Even young children, starting at the age of 2 or 3, they start to recognize their body boundaries. And we need to teach them about body autonomy. We need to teach them about protecting their body, about being advocates for their own body, and teaching them messages like, my body belongs to me, and using proper names for body parts. And this is something I get asked about a lot, but it is important to give our kids vocabulary so that if something happens to them, they can talk to us about it. And we know that they have language to describe their experiences. That's a lot of times why kids won't say anything, because they don't know how to say something. They don't even yet have language to describe their experience. Now, you might hear a lot about good touch and bad touch. I do not like those words, because when you say bad touch and then a child comes to you and they have to talk to you about that, they take on, because of where they are developmentally and that young preschool age and school age kids, they interpret that as, I have done something bad. I have been bad. I am bad. And I think that is not a good framework. It's well intended, but better words are safe or unsafe. This is safe touch. This is unsafe touch. This is appropriate touch. This is not appropriate touch. That way, we're not telling them something that they're doing something bad. If something's unsafe, that is inherently not their fault. And so just having safe and unsafe, appropriate, inappropriate touch in very simple terms, just telling them, as you know, you're doing, especially with younger children, if you're helping them with bathing and dressing and all of those things that we do as parents, just reminding them of safe touch and unsafe touch, or who is allowed in what context access to their body. That's really important. For school-age kids, you really want to introduce the concept of respect for boundaries. And we reinforce trusted adults. We say, no secrets, only surprises. We don't allow secrets in this family. And that is a rule that I have in my family. We don't have any secrets. There is no whispering in our family. Anything that is said can be said out in the open. And if it's a private conversation that needs to be had, then that's for another time. But there is no secrets. There are no secrets. My kids know. They will say, can you keep a secret? No, I cannot. I cannot keep a secret from my parents. So you need to know that whatever you tell me, I am going to tell my parents. So teaching our kids to say that, if anybody ever asks you, can you keep a secret? Say, no, I cannot keep secrets from my parents. I'm not allowed to keep secrets from my parents. I need you to give me permission or to know that I will tell my parents whatever you say. And no secrets, only surprises. Yes, you can plan a surprise. So if you're planning a surprise birthday gift, a surprise for, you know, to celebrate something great, you can have those surprises. But it is really important to have no secrets, because kids are very easy to groom into secrets, and they see an adult as trusted, and many times that adult may be someone that you trust as well, and so they have vicarious trust through that. No secrets except with your parents. That is it. And even that, having a culture of no secrets is important. When you get to the teens and the young adults, discussing healthy versus unhealthy relationships is really important. Talking about online safety and coercion and peer pressure and keeping themselves safe online. I usually ask my teenage patients when I see them in the clinic, and they tell me, I say, tell me about your online activities. So they'll tell me about social media or what they do. And then I say, okay, what do you do to keep yourself safe online? and they look like I've just arrived from Mars. Like, what do you mean? But they do know what it means to feel unsafe on social media. They do know what it's like to experience bullying or aggression or to see things that make them uncomfortable. So empowering them to have their own online safety is really important. We have to model this concept of body autonomy in our everyday life. And this is important because we need to teach our kids to say no when they don't want touch. Now, that means that sometimes when we've grown up and how culture is, like when your relative comes to visit and you do not want to kiss them on the lips and we tell them, no, you have to kiss them as a sign of respect. It's really confusing for kids to figure that out. Like, I can't say no to this person, but I can say no to this person. Well, this person you love and trust and respect, but this person you love and trust and respect. And you can see how those mixed messages are really hard for kids who are wired to think literally, who can I say no to and who can I not? We need to teach them to respect their instincts. When they feel like someone is violating their boundaries, that's important. I had a teenager one time tell me about her vague discomfort with one of her Sunday school leaders, who she said just sat too close. And when he sat, you know, his leg would touch hers. And she had trouble even voicing this, feeling like, how can I say anything about my Sunday school teacher? But for me, as a grown woman, I'm thinking, no, that is not okay for a grown man to sit that close to a teenage girl, and you need to talk about it. And most of the time when we have people who are looking for predators who are looking for vulnerabilities, they're looking for kids who are not going to say no. And it's important to say no. Don't be afraid about being rude. We can figure that out later. We can go back and apologize if we need to, but it's much more important to be safe than it is to be polite. So if they say, you know, if an adult is saying, I want to give you a hug, no, I'm not comfortable with that. No, just saying no. I would make my children practice this and until they were just like, Mom, come on. No, I need to hear it in your voice. Be assertive and saying no. Asking, so it can be good to ask them permission. Hey, can I give you a hug? And model that as consent, because that is important. No, they don't have to sit on someone's lap. No, they don't have to hug someone they don't want to hug. Just, and sometimes we take that their embarrassment on as parents and we think, oh, I'm sorry. You know, they're not, we don't have to apologize for that. Just say, how about a handshake instead? How about a high five? How about just a friendly hello? We're just going with a friendly hello today. And that is okay. Encouraging them to listen to their instincts. That can be really important. Empowering kids to say no and trust their instincts is essential in protecting them from unsafe situations, because kids can sense when something feels off, but they don't have those words to describe their discomfort. Their brains are still developing, and the ability to process complex emotions and say what they're feeling, it can feel wrong, especially if it's an adult or an authority figure. And additionally, many kids are conditioned to be polite or obedient and don't make anybody else feel uncomfortable, which can make saying no feel unnatural or wrong or sinful. And shame plays a powerful role in that. Without understanding why, a kid might feel embarrassed or guilty or confused about their reaction. So they just don't speak up because they just aren't sure how to process it. So we have to teach kids their feelings are valid, their voice matters, they never have to explain or justify a no when something just doesn't feel right. Listen to their gut. Practice saying no in small ways and reinforce that safe adults will always respect their boundaries. That can help build confidence and engage in self-protection and personal agency. Teaching kids to be assertive and saying no, that is a vital part of protecting them from unsafe situations. They need to know they have the right to set boundaries. Saying no is not rude. It is strong. It is smart. It is brave. And use a clear, confident voice and strong body language when refusing something that makes them feel uncomfortable. So again, you know, it's important to look for those behaviors that maybe don't look like strangers. Maybe it can be family members or a friend or a coach is looking for those predatory grooming behaviors like bribery or flattery or manipulation. It's saying that, you know, fear, secrecy, threats, those are not acceptable. And predators will often test the boundaries of small requests before escalating. So teaching kids to recognize and resist even when it's early is really important. And again, saying that safe adults will always respect their no. Listen, I have a lot more to say about this. I'll be talking about this through some more Fridays in April and talking about assault and how we have some protective factors for kids, how we can empower especially teens and college students to protect themselves. But I wanted to talk today about that early level and looking at some prevention for abuse and assault early on. And those are some ways that you can do it. Make sure you're approachable with your kids. If you're not saying anything else to your kids, but you can always talk to me about anything until they're rolling their eyes and saying, I know, I know, I know, using those everyday moments to talk about safety and how to respond in those uncomfortable situations, that can go a long way. As I said, keep tuned in. I'll be talking specifically about college and high school students on some further Fridays in April. But in the meantime, wherever you are on this Friday, I pray the Lord will bless you and keep you and make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you and give you peace. And I can't wait to see you here next week. As always, we've got a great week lined up for you. Thanks again for Share-a-thon. And we'll see you next week as we head into Easter.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.